What was your impression of Donald Trump when you saw him?
You know, he looked less orange, more yellowish.
Yes. More yellowish. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A., also in California in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI and Round Mountains, KKRN. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's Queso, Eugene's KEPW, Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950, KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day for your listening convenience on the internets, on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites, blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today. We have a whole lot of stuff to get to. I suspect it's even some stuff you may not have heard of yet out there in the world, with everyone distracted by the orange slash yellowish man who is on trial in New York.
Yes.
It's was sort of seven steps forward and two steps back, and then another five steps forward again, at least in Donald Trump's criminal trial in New York on 34 felony counts related to his having used hush money to cover up a sexual affair in the weeks just before the 2016 election in hopes of cheating to win it. We will get to that in a bit, maybe. Also in a bit, Desi Doyen will have our latest Green News report.
Yes.
With news on some unbelievable downpours in recent days, everywhere from Louisiana, where I think 8 inches of rain fell in about 2 hours in New Orleans last weekend, to the desert of Dubai in the Middle East, where unbelievable rains, about 10 inches in a day, just wreaked absolute havoc there. All of which underscores a new report detailing the trillions of dollars per year that our climate crisis will soon be costing all of us for the loss and damage that it will cause. But while the worst of it may still be a few years away, as Des, you discuss in our Green News report a bit later, you know, before it gets really expensive, it's already costing all of us right now. And that is according to none other than Jerome Powell, the Donald Trump appointed chair of the Federal Reserve. That's the U.S. Central Bank. Last month, in testimony to Congress, according to the United Business Journal, Powell highlighted a significant yet overlooked contributor to persistently high inflation rates in recent months. That would be soaring insurance costs. Powell emphasized that various types of insurance, including home and car insurance, have experienced substantial surges in recent years, impeding the Fed's efforts to achieve its target for inflation of just 2%. He noted housing and automobile insurance as a significant source of inflation in recent years.
Yes, here he is at that hearing.
You know, in the longer term, companies are withdrawing from writing insurance in some coastal areas, and you got to think 10 years from now, how are you going to get housing insurance? And, you know, maybe the government will have to step in, but it's a significant issue.
Yeah, it's a significant issue. Recent data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics corroborates Powell's observations, revealing a notable increase in the metric for auto insurance. Now, you may have noticed your auto insurance went way up this year. I know mine did. This metric, encompassing physical damage, liability, and miscellaneous insurance coverage for private passenger vehicles, surged by 20.6% over the past year. Additionally, a study conducted by S&P Global Market Intelligence unveiled a sharp 11.3% increase in homeowners insurance premiums last year. Experts attribute the escalating insurance premiums to various factors. Powell said there were millions of them, but the one that a lot of experts are focusing on is the impacts of climate change. A recent study from Bankrate underscores how the escalating frequency of extreme weather events attributed to climate change is significantly increasing the risk exposure for insurance companies. Over the past decade, the U.S. has incurred a staggering $1.1 trillion in damages from severe weather incidents. $1.1 trillion, marking the highest figure on record. This surge in weather-related losses has directly contributed to a notable uptick in insurance costs. To mitigate their exposure to potential insolvency resulting from catastrophic weather events, insurance companies rely on reinsurance companies. So the insurance companies, they get insurance to help pay their costs if they actually have to pay out their insurance. However, given the heightened probability of severe weather conditions capable of inflicting substantial damage to properties, reinsurance firms are now demanding higher premiums from insurers for their services. Consequently, insurers are passing on the increased cost to policyholders, resulting in elevated insurance premiums across the board. And yes, that is helping to keep inflation higher than it used to be. You're wondering why your car insurance spiked this year? Well, there you go. Car insurance rates are now reaching nearly 50-year highs. In some of the most high-risk areas, insurance companies have even opted to cease offering coverage altogether, exacerbating the challenges faced by homeowners. Powell, in his testimony, acknowledged the severity of the situation, emphasizing that insurance companies are retreating from underwriting policies in coastal regions, in particular due to the escalating risks posed by climate change-induced weather events. Daily Coast blogger Pakalolo points us to a real-life example of how these spiking insurance rates, thanks to man-made climate change, for some reason or another, Republicans want to do nothing about, and in fact, they want to make it worse. This is an example of how these rates are making home ownership unaffordable for many people, particularly in the so far worse affected areas. And in fact, are now driving some people out of their homes entirely. This is an example from the BBC last month when Frances Acuna received her flood insurance quote for the coming year. She got a shock. It would be increasing from $450 to $1,893. I'm not a mathematician, but I think that's well over a 300% increase, Des.
Yeah, which is a very shocking and sudden increase, and particularly difficult for older people on fixed incomes to be able to accommodate.
Well, Acuna said, quote, "I couldn't pay it. And so now I don't have flood insurance, but I don't feel alone. Most of my neighbors don't have flood insurance either." Acuna is actually a single mother of three. She lives in Dove Springs in southeast Austin, Texas. The astronomical rise in flood insurance coupled with an affordable housing crisis is pushing many historic Latino communities out of the area. in March of this year. Acuna, a local community health organizer, was forced to leave. This is a neighborhood she has lived in for decades, but because of the increase in the costs of insurance, she's got to leave. She said, quote, I bought this house thinking I would die in it. She says she told the BBC in tears over the decision that she was forced to make. She says, I can't afford to live here anymore. Her insurance went up because of, and we've reported this on the Green News Report, as I recall, a change in floodplain mapping.
Yes. The FEMA finally updated flood maps to actually reflect the actual risk.
The actual threat.
Now, not the ones that were based on maps from, 20, 30, 50 years ago.
Correct. That came following 2018 when the National Weather Service updated its flood models to reflect 25 years worth of recent flood data that had not been included in those maps. Thousands of houses in Austin that were previously expected to flood only once every 500 years? Well, they were upgraded to a risk of one in every 100 years. With the new data analysis indicating that Austin now was at a higher risk of flooding than previously estimated, insurance policies for homes have skyrocketed, not just in Austin, but across Texas. The hike in insurance costs in Austin mirrors a crisis unfolding across America, the BBC reports, along both coasts and through the Midwest. So, pretty much everywhere.
Yes, really, everywhere.
California State Senator Bill Dodd warned last year, if you're not worried, you're not paying attention. Or maybe you're not listening to the broadcast. I don't know. That, he said, following a report which found Florida, California, and Louisiana. Remember, they got 8 inches of rain in 2 hours last weekend. Florida, California, and Louisiana would see dramatic rises in home insurance premiums. That's what he said last year after that report. Now, I guess you can add Texas to the list. In 2022, insurance firm Allstate paused selling new home and condo insurance policies in California out here. Quote, our payments to help California residents recover from accidents and disasters have increased significantly in recent years due to high repair costs and more frequent and severe weather, said a spokesperson for Allstate. In 23, State Farm, one of the biggest insurance providers in the nation, announced that it too would stop selling new home insurance policies in California due in part to what they describe as, quote, growing catastrophe exposure. Wonder what they mean by that. But it is a darling and disarming way to put it, I think. Growing catastrophe exposure.
Now that's a euphemism.
It was the latest insurer to pull back from the state, which has been hit by devastating wildfires and floods in recent years. And because it's California, of course, there is always the ever-looming threat of a major earthquake. But that has already sort of been baked in for years into the insurance prices in California. So, yeah, it's climate change. Meanwhile, in Florida, Farmers Insurance discontinued its own brand home insurance in the state, joining at least a dozen insurers there who had already left. The abandonment of these areas is part of a wider story. Thanks to climate change, the U.S. is becoming a more volatile place to live. Hurricanes, floods, storms, and fires have caused widespread mass destruction in recent years. A 2022 report analyzed 120 million homes and found 1 in 10 of them were impacted by related natural disasters. Winter storms impacted 12.7 million homes, causing $15 billion in damage in 2021 alone. Hurricanes caused $33 billion in damage across more than a million homes that same year. And BBC notes, the future looks even worse. They cite the recent report by First Street Foundation, nonprofit focusing on climate risk research, finding nearly 24 million properties in the U.S. are at risk from damaging winds, 4.5 million properties at risk from wildfires, and a further 12 million properties that have a significant risk of flooding, in addition to properties in the FEMA special flood hazard areas. The 100-year flood zone that the government has already identified, that Desi already mentioned. Private insurance companies are effectively labeling areas now as uninsurable, the report found. Another major concern is the real estate market continuing as usual in the face of increasing extreme weather, meaning that home buyers have no idea when they are buying in a high-risk area. The gap between the cost of climate risk and the real estate market has been described as a, quote, climate bubble. A recent study found residential properties that are at risk of flooding are grossly overvalued by up to $237 billion. That means when a property is put on the market for sale, the cost of flooding is not currently reflected in the value of the home. Essentially, the housing market is mispricing the risk. So prices are going up for houses, and they're being sold, and buyers have no idea how much it may cost them for flood insurance or just floods. In Miami, for example, home prices continue to rise. To rise, despite all of this, in Miami, to rise by 27%, despite NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, predicting that Southeast cities like Miami will be facing more than 30 days of high tide, that sunny day flooding, 30 days a year by 2050. That's flooding just from, not from huge storms, that hurricanes coming in. That's just from the tide coming in. You know, on a beautiful sunny day, and your house is flooded thanks to rising oceans. Projected sea level rise, which Miami is particularly vulnerable to, threatens $400 billion worth of Florida property, which I suspect is not part of the real estate agent's sales pitch when she's out there pointing to what a great view of the ocean you have from your back patio.
Just wait till they find out what happens to their drinking water when saltwater intrusion starts occurring.
Well, you had to add that, didn't you?
Yeah, sorry.
First Street Foundation's report last year found that policies for 39 million properties, roughly a quarter of all homes in the U.S., are underpriced for the climate risk to insure those properties. Evelyn Hsu, a senior researcher at the First Street Foundation, the lead author on this report, said, quote, "For decades, we've chosen to build and develop in areas that we believed did not have significant risk, but due to impacts of climate change, those are very rapidly beginning to look like areas we've avoided in the past." One state-level action that could help mitigate the impacts of climate change, according to the BBC, is the implementation of flood disclosures. Organizations like the NRDC have urged states to require flood disclosure policies during property sales to help buyers decide whether buying is worth the risk. But of course, research has shown disclosure can devalue flood-prone properties. So, you know, who wants to do that? Unless they're forced to by the government. But it can also, if they do make these disclosures, it can discourage development in risky areas, which would be a very smart thing at this point.
Yeah, that's the idea. In order to prevent states and localities making it possible to build in these super vulnerable areas, setting these homeowners up for failure.
Yep. The number of states requiring flood disclosure policies is slowly increasing, but Florida remains noticeably absent from that list of states, and one-third of states have no requirement that sellers must disclose a property's flood risk to potential buyers. So while nobody, no states, are doing a particularly wonderful job on all of this, But, you know, if you're wondering why Republicans are especially keen to characterize climate change as a hoax or something that we don't really have to worry about, or, well, it's just too late to do anything about it other than to try to mitigate it, hope for the best. So long as that doesn't mean, you know, raising taxes for their rich friends. It's not only the fact that those politicians get huge sums of money from the fossil fuel industry, which is causing the problem, but, you know, right now with a Democrat in the White House, they have every reason in the world to want to keep inflation high, to keep it from coming down, and to continue blaming Democrats for rising costs of homes and home insurance, even though a lot of it has to do with the climate change that they are pretending doesn't exist. There is a reason that we have been covering and warning about the climate crisis on this program and in our Green News Report for more than 15 years now, I think, on the Green News Report. It's because it is a real and huge issue. And perhaps the most underreported issue of our time, because it affects absolutely everything, whether or not some people wish to discuss it or not. Anyway, that's my, 20-minute or so teaser for Desi's 6-minute Green News Report coming up a little bit later this hour. Okay, in other news, even though the two front-running candidates for president in each of the two major parties at this point, that would be Joe Biden and Donald Trump, have each won the necessary number of party delegates in primary elections so far this year to officially win their party's nomination for president when the parties meet for their national conventions this summer, primary season continues nonetheless. This week on, April 21, Wyoming Republicans will hold their state convention to certify their preference for president. I wonder who they will choose.
It's a mystery.
And while that's a closed convention only for party members, Republicans in Puerto Rico are also scheduled to hold their open primaries on Sunday this week, where any registered voter can vote, as I understand it. And then coming up on Tuesday next week, April 23, the critical battleground state of Pennsylvania is holding its primaries for both parties. In addition to the presidential races, however, Pennsylvania's primary ballots for both Republicans and Democrats will also include primary voting for the U.S. Senate and for House and statewide offices, as well as a number of local races and ballot initiatives. The Commonwealth does, however, also have closed primaries. So if you're not already registered as either a Democrat or a Republican, you won't be able to participate on Tuesday, to my knowledge, but registered voters will, registered, if you're registered to one of the two parties, will be able to vote on Tuesday. So please get out there, exercise your rights, and yes, it's also, as we've noted, a great chance to make sure that you are currently registered as you believe that you are. And also, this just in before airtime from BradBlog.com's legal analyst, Ernie Canning, who sent me the heads up. This appears to be very good news out of the battleground state of Nevada. The Nevada Supreme Court has reversed a lower trial court decision, now allowing a pro-abortion rights ballot initiative for this November's general election. Democratic Attorney Mark Elias confirms that breaking news on Twitter today, congratulating the Nevadans for Reproductive Freedom, a group who fought for this, congratulating them on their victory. That is likely to, frankly, spark turnout in Nevada this November. And speaking of presidential battleground states, so last week I mentioned a story that I didn't yet know what to make of. Didn't think it was going to turn into much of anything, and hopefully it still will not. But I had to cover it a bit again this past week as well, and now again today, because what I thought was most likely ultimately a non-story And frankly, I still hope that it will be. It's not yet a non-story and is actually becoming more of a story each day now, it seems. You may remember I reported on the office of Ohio's Republican Secretary of State, Frank LaRose, informing state Democrats that due to state law, Joe Biden might not be certified to appear on the Buckeye State's ballot this year. State law, apparently, requires that the major political parties notify the state about their selected presidential candidates 90 days before Election Day, which this year would be August 7. But the Democratic National Convention this year, when party delegates will officially nominate Joe Biden for re-election, is not scheduled to begin until August 19 this year. Now, when something similar happened back in 2020, when Democrats and Republicans had scheduled their national nominating conventions after the Ohio deadline, the state's GOP-controlled legislature simply met and passed a resolution to change the deadline to accommodate, well, at least to accommodate Trump's nomination and, oh yeah, Joe Biden's. But they did that back in 2020 for only that year. So now it's a problem again, but only for Democrats, because Republicans this year have set their convention for July. And last week, Ohio's Secretary of State notified state Democrats that Joe Biden would not be on this year's ballot in Ohio unless Democrats either move the date for their convention, which, of course, ain't going to happen. Everything's already planned and booked and in place, et cetera. Or the Republican-controlled state legislature, well, they could change the statute's deadline as they did in 2020 when it would have affected Donald Trump. But if the state legislature was going to do that, LaRose's office informed Democrats last week that they would have to do so by May 9, I guess, to meet the legislature's own deadline in state law for doing so. And do you think Ohio Republicans are in a rush to do that? Now, the second time, that's what we mentioned last week. The second time we mentioned this story was earlier this week, I believe. It was because Alabama's Secretary of State had informed Democrats there about a similar statutory deadline back in 2020 when Republicans were running afoul of that deadline. The state sort of accepted an informal provisional certification, a promise of a sort from GOP officials that, yeah, Donald Trump was going to be the candidate, even though their convention wasn't going to happen until after the state deadline. But that was all fine in Alabama, at least back in 2020. Theoretically, they will now allow Democrats to do the same thing in Alabama this year. We'll see, though, to be honest, it sort of seems unlikely that Joe Biden has much of a chance of winning in Alabama. Though, frankly, you know, you never know. We covered that story yesterday of how turnout doubled in the state's newly redrawn second congressional district in Alabama last month in the Super Tuesday primary after the federal courts forced the state to redraw their racially gerrymandered U.S. House maps in order to accommodate a second black majority voting district in the state. So you never know. But Ohio, even though it's swung much more to the right in recent years, it used to be considered a swing state, and Ohio has a big U.S. Senate race this year where Democratic Senator Sherrod Brown is running for re-election. So Ohio's ballot this year and who is and isn't on it is actually a very big deal. Even if it has seemed unthinkable that they would leave off the sitting Democratic president running for re-election this year due to some random statutory deadline issue that they have waived in previous years without a problem, at least to help the then sitting Republican presidential president who was running for re-election 4 years ago. So, and this, of course, is nothing like the move by the Colorado Supreme Court or the Maine Secretary of State to keep Donald Trump off the ballot in those states, because in those cases, he clearly violated the Constitution's insurrection disqualification clause, which the U.S. Supreme Court subsequently fixed for him by making up a heretofore unknown and unwritten in the Constitution rule that the very clear amendment barring insurrectionists from office can't be enacted unless Congress first writes a law to do so. They just made that up out of whole cloth, but oh, and only that only matters for federal officials for some reason, including the president of the United States. So at least there was cause there. Here, it's a simple statutory deadline matter that can be easily changed, as it has been in the past when necessary. Anyway, as noted, I wasn't even sure this was worth covering when I first noticed this story out of Ohio, because it seemed like some stupid partisan nonsense that was going to get itself worked out. It still feels like that to me. It still feels like that will happen. But as USA Today reports today, Ohio officials rejected a plan from Democrats to get President Joe Biden on the November ballot after the party scheduled its convention past the state election deadline. In a letter to Secretary of State Frank LaRose's office obtained by the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau, Attorney Don McTeague said the Democratic Party would provisionally certify Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris ahead of the August 7 deadline, you know, just as Republicans did in Alabama back in 2020. They provisionally certified their candidate. McTeague noted that Joe Biden had already secured enough delegates for the Democratic nomination after facing no significant primary challenge. Biden easily won in Ohio. He won 87% of the vote there. Quote, if President Biden and Vice President Harris are not listed on the ballot as the Democratic Party candidates, their supporters in Ohio will be stripped of the opportunity to associate with their preferred candidate, wrote McTeague. But Ohio's Republican Attorney General Dave Yost's office now says provisional approval by the party will not work. Nor can Secretary of State LaRose unilaterally change election deadlines. An attorney at the state AG's office told the Secretary of State's office in a letter, quote, the law mandates the Democratic Party actually certify its president and vice president candidates on or before August 7, 2024. The letter appears to leave Democrats with two options, according to the paper: rely on the GOP state legislature, or sue. Lawmakers could pass an exemption to the 90-day deadline by May 9, as they did in 2020 when both parties scheduled their conventions too late, but the chances of that, according to USA Today, are now slim. Top state Democrats said they're deferring to the Biden campaign and Democratic National Committee, and Republican leaders are believed unlikely to lend a helping hand. Quote, I think it's a Democratic problem, said Republican State Senate President Matt Huffman. Quote, there should have to be a Democratic solution. That hasn't been proposed to me, he said. Ohio isn't the only state with election deadlines before the convention, the paper notes. Alabama and Washington are in the same boat, though Washington's Secretary of State, a Democrat, will accept a provisional certification, according to the Seattle Times. Also, Oklahoma, Illinois, Washington, and Montana did the same with both parties back in 2020. The Democratic Attorney McTeague and a spokesman for Biden's campaign declined to answer questions about potential next steps other than to say, quote, Joe Biden will be on the ballot in all 50 states. State officials have the ability to grant provisional ballot access certification prior to the conclusion of presidential nominating conventions. But do they? We shall see. As noted, this did not seem like a story when I first noticed it and started covering it, but kind of something told me maybe I should mention it.
Yeah, it sounds like they really are going to do it.
I'm still sort of hoping it's not really a story, but it's kind of looking like more of one as the days go on. So as we promised last week on this, we'll keep our eyes on it. Republicans wouldn't really do this, would they? Take a quick break here, and we'll come back with an update on the criminal trial proceeding in New York for the Republican candidate, Donald Trump. That's next on the broadcast, and some very encouraging news for workers in the South, I think. All of that is next on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Would they?
The broadcast and the Green News Report are 100% independent, 100% listener-supported. But we can't do it alone. We need you. Please help us bring real facts to listeners at independent stations around the nation. Please drop by bradblog.com/donate. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Stormy Daniels, she went through all the legal channels.
Welcome back to the broadcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. That, by the way, is Bethany Barber, the daughter of attorney and frequent guest on the broadcast, Keith Barber. We may be playing that once or twice in the weeks ahead, I suspect.
It's really good.
It is good. Maybe we'll play the whole thing at some point. Welcome back to the broadcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. A jury of 12 people have now officially been seated as we go to air today in former President Donald Trump's criminal hush money trial in New York for having paid off a porn star just before the 2016 election to keep quiet about an alleged affair that they had in hopes of helping him to win that year's presidential election, which he did. He then sent payments to cover it all up each month, month after month, for the, I think, the entirety of the first year while he was serving in the White House. Yes, he was paying out hush money payments from the White House. The court turned quickly thereafter, after selecting 12 people, to selecting six alternate jurors, which will be needed to be completed before opening statements can begin, which could be as soon as Monday if they continue to stay on track. There was some concern about that earlier on Thursday when two of the seven jurors who had already been selected were dismissed after Judge Juan Merchan revealed in court that one of the seven, a cancer nurse, had, quote, conveyed that after sleeping on it overnight, she had concerns about her ability to be fair and impartial in this case. And though jurors' names are being kept confidential, the woman told the judge and the lawyers that she had doubts after she said aspects of her identity had been made public. Quote, yesterday alone, I had friends, colleagues, and family, she said, push things to my phone regarding questioning my identity as a juror. I don't believe at this point I can be fair and unbiased and let the outside influences not affect my decision-making in the courtroom, she said. A second seated juror was also dismissed after prosecutors raised concerns that he may not have been honest in answering a jury selection question by saying that he had never been accused of or convicted of a crime. The IT professional in this case was summoned to court to answer questions after prosecutors said they found an article about a person with the same name as him who had been arrested in the 90s for tearing down political posters pertaining to the political right in suburban Westchester County because the juror was questioned Thursday at the judge's bench, off microphone, out of earshot of reporters. It's not yet known whether the man confirmed or denied the issue. In any event, he was dismissed. Thursday's events laid bare the inherent challenge of selecting a jury for such a landmark high publicity case. According to AP, more than half the members of a group of 96 prospective jurors brought into the courtroom were dismissed on Thursday, most after saying they doubted their own ability to be fair and impartial. After dismissing from the jury the nurse who had been selected, Mershon then ordered journalists in the court not to report prospective jurors' answers to questions about their current and former employers. Quote, "We just lost probably what would have been a very good juror for this case," the judge said after dismissing her. And the first thing that she said was she was afraid and intimidated by the press and everything that had happened, which I thought of when I saw the reports this week the various jurors. It's like they're being very specific about who these people are.
Yeah, a lot of really super identifying details that would make it very easy to figure out who they are.
The press has now been instructed to leave out identifying information from their coverage.
Like where they work, how many kids they have, they live.
And the court transcript will redact some of that information. Prosecutors had asked that the employer inquiries be axed entirely from the jury questionnaire. The district attorney's office on Monday sought also a $3,000, this is Monday, beginning of the week, a $3,000 fine for Trump for three different Truth Social posts that he made that they charge violated the judge's gag order against him, barring him from speaking about jurors or witnesses in the case. Since then, prosecutors noted on Thursday, he has made seven additional posts that they believe violate that gag order. Several of the posts involved an article that referred to former Trump lawyer Michael Cohen as a, quote, serial perjurer. Remember, Michael Cohen is going to be a key witness in this case. Donald Trump is circulating posts that call him a serial perjurer. That would seem to be strictly in violation of the gag order. And another post from Wednesday repeated a claim by Fox News host Jesse Waters claiming that liberal activists were lying to get onto the jury. A hearing on those matters is scheduled for next week, and the judge has said that he would hold Trump to account for violations of his gag order, including fines and up to, if necessary, imprisonment. We shall see. But for now, if this pace continues, opening statements in the first ever criminal trial against the former president, the first of four criminal trials that he's facing, could begin in New York as soon as Monday. While all of that is sucking up much of the mainstream media oxygen, sort of understandably, there is some very important stuff going on in the South right now, specifically in Tennessee this week, that deserves much more attention than it is getting, frankly. As it appears to be, at least as of today, some potentially very good news for workers and for unions. Yes, in the South. This via Steve Greenhouse at The Guardian, who he was on this show with us not too long ago. The United Auto Workers, UAW, has launched an ambitious campaign to unionize 13 non-union automakers across the U.S., and the first big test is this week. It begins this week as 4,300 Volkswagen workers in Chattanooga, Tennessee, started voting on Wednesday as to whether to unionize to join the UAW. Many VW workers are predicting victory in this election. Quote, "We are going to win," said Lisa Elliott, a quality control worker at VW. "We have the momentum. I know this will be a historic event," she said. She has worked at VW since 2019 when the UAW narrowly lost a unionization vote in Chattanooga, but she says the mood today is very different. She said most workers are jazzed about unionizing now because of the UAW's big victory in last fall's strike and contract fight with GM, Ford, and Stellantis, which owns Jeep and Chrysler. Elliott said, quote, "I support a union because we don't have a voice now, and there are some serious issues that need to be addressed. If the union wins here," she said, "it will definitely encourage workers in other factories." The vote in Chattanooga is right now underway. It runs from Wednesday through Friday this week. The UAW's campaign has targeted 13 companies, including Toyota, Tesla, hi Elon, and Hyundai, that have roughly 150,000 workers at 36 currently non-union plants. After VW, the next vote will be at the Mercedes plant in Vance, Alabama, where a supermajority of the 5,000 workers there have already signed cards requesting a unionization vote. Jeremy Kimbrell, a worker at the Mercedes plant in Alabama, said, "I have great confidence that the union drive will be successful. Very few are openly against it," he said. "A victory at Volkswagen would make a victory at Mercedes much more likely," said Joseph McCartan, a labor historian at Georgetown. "Victories at both Volkswagen and Mercedes would be nothing less than an earthquake," he said. "This would be the biggest breakthrough in private sector organizing in decades. It would mean that the anti-union citadel in the South that has repulsed effort after effort has been breached to organize those factories." I like it. The UAW's strike last year showed that the UAW can deliver, said Stephen Sylvia, a political science professor at American University. "It really was a turning point for the UAW," he said. "For 30 years, the UAW was focused on fighting austerity and often agreed to concessions. But," he said, "when Sean Fain came in as UAW president in March of last year, he turned things around, focused on making gains for the workers." The UAW's deal with Detroit automakers, the one that they struck and won for last year, includes raises of 25% over 4.5 years, more than the total raises won in the previous 22 years. The contract also calls for improved pensions, restoring the cost of living allowance, increasing the top wage to $40 an hour, and raising starting pay by 68%. If they're doing a union drive, they can now point to last fall's contract settlement and say, "This is what the union can do for you," said Sylvia. They couldn't say that before. Meanwhile, Tennessee's governor, Bill Lee, said, quote, "It would be a big mistake for the VW workers to risk their future by unionizing."
That's a threat.
Alabama's governor, Kate Ivey, wrote, quote, "Alabama has become a national leader in automotive manufacturing, and all this was achieved without a unionized workforce. Unfortunately, the Alabama model for economic success is under attack." She considers it under attack. Sean Fain fired back, saying that Ivy, quote, "dared to say that the economic model of the South is under attack." She's damn right it is. It's under attack because workers are fed up with getting screwed, he said. And then in a unprecedented, really, a high profile attempt to head off unionization of their state's auto factories, the governors of six different southern states, all Republican, warned their residents in a joint statement that joining the UAW would threaten jobs and, quote, "the values we live by." The unprecedented statement from the governors came just a day before the Volkswagen factory in Chattanooga was set to begin voting on joining the UAW. Quote, "The reality is companies have choices when it comes to where to invest and bring jobs and opportunity," the governors said. The governors of Tennessee, Alabama, Georgia, Mississippi, South Carolina, and Texas all wrote, quote, "Unionization would certainly put our state's jobs in jeopardy." Really? Would it? How about if the plants in all of the states were union? Then you wouldn't have to worry about that, would you, governors? The remarkable intervention against the best interests of their own constituents, by the way, follows signs of optimism among pro-union workers at the VW plant. Quote, "They're so scared," said UAW strategist Chris Brooks on social media as he reposted Governor Kay Ivey's comments about the statement. An economist who has closely studied unionization of the South called the statement from the governors, quote, "unprecedented and shocking," and said it discouraged workers from exercising their legal right to organize. It implies that the governors fear that the UAW will prevail in the election and that the UAW's success could upend their economic models built on low pay and minimal worker voice could be coming to an end. Meanwhile, I should note, while there was all six of those governors who joined together to tell workers that they should work for less, they were all Republican. But Democratic Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear, in a state which is also facing a UAW organizing effort at a Toyota factory there in Georgetown, he said on social media last week that unions have raised workers' standards of living and that he was, quote, proud to stand shoulder to shoulder with the UAW. Quick break, and we are back with Desi Doyen in the Green News Report right after this. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't touch that dial. Hey, this is Brad. Please consider supporting whichever progressive media outlet is serving you. Most, just like us, do not receive corporate or political support. We all need your support to counter the powerful corporate media echo chamber. From Desi Doyen and myself, thank you. Boy, yeah, another big day. Once again, running late, so we'll get to it. Our latest Green News Report.
You know, I've been in Dubai many times when it rains and things do not go well, but this was on a different scale.
Astonishing, historic deluge inundates Dubai. Climate impacts will cost global economy about $38 trillion a year by 2050, what? New study estimates. Plus,
today we're making it clear that no job should be a death sentence.
Biden administration cracks down on toxic silica dust to protect workers' lungs.
All of those crackdowns and more straight ahead from BradBlog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
You may remember my predecessor promised infrastructure week after week after week for 4 years and never built a damn thing. Yeah! Nothing. Nothing.
Well, I don't know about that. Seems like he built 4 pretty good criminal cases against himself. Give him credit, Joe Biden. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, before you get to the news, even though it is always Earth Day around here at the Green News Report, got another Earth Day coming up.
Yes, we do, on April 22nd. So please check out local events to celebrate the only planet in the universe known to support life.
Good idea. What else you got for us today?
Well, Dubai in the United Arab Emirates this week was the newest victim of historic rains and floods, demonstrating again how existing infrastructure is not designed to withstand more frequent extreme weather events that are becoming more severe due to man-made climate change. Slow-moving storms dumped as much as 10 inches of rain in 24 hours, more than 2 years' worth of rain in a single day, the worst ever in Dubai in 75 years of record keeping.
In Dubai, the desert.
Yes.
10 inches of rain.
In one day.
Oh, it's all going very well.
The fast rising floods shut down the city and the world's second busiest airports. Officials and experts say cloud seeding was not a factor and could not have generated the record deluge.
Are some people claiming that this was man-made somehow?
Yes, they were, but It's not.
Okay.
The unseasonal rain bombs also swept across the Arabian Peninsula, killing at least 100 people across Oman, Pakistan, and deeply impoverished Afghanistan. The floods also destroyed crops, killed livestock, and destroyed or damaged hundreds of homes. Last week in the United States, New Orleans was similarly inundated by torrential rains of as much as 8 inches in just a few hours.
8 inches? In just a couple of hours?
Yes.
Okay.
Extreme rainfall events are becoming more common due to human-caused global warming because a warmer atmosphere holds more moisture. In the UK, officials warn of potential food shortages and price spikes because extreme rains have decimated crop yields and prevented farmers in some parts from even planting crops like potatoes, wheat, and vegetables during the key spring season. A new study warns that climate change will inflict global economic losses to the tune of about $38 trillion a year.
Trillion?
Yes.
A year?
By 2049, as extreme weather destroys infrastructure and hammers agricultural yields and labor productivity. The study, published in the journal Nature this week, projects that rising loss and damage from more frequent weather disasters will slash overall global income by nearly 20% over the next 25 years. Losses will hit everywhere, but developing countries will suffer the most. However, the researchers say that speeding up the transition away from fossil fuels could reduce those losses over the long term. And it would be far cheaper. They estimate the cost of transitioning to clean energy is 1/6 the cost of economic damages from climate change. In better news,
it couldn't be worse.
Here in the U.S., the Federal Mine Safety and Health Administration finalized new rules to significantly limit workers' exposure to toxic silica dust. Silica dust is a carcinogen that threatens miners across numerous sectors like coal and metals, causing incurable diseases like lung cancer and silicosis and kidney diseases, even among young miners. Biden Labor Secretary Julie Hsu said the new rules strengthen respiratory protection standards against all workplace airborne hazards and will save lives.
We estimate that this final rule is going to save more than 1,000 lives and prevent severe illnesses for thousands more.
And finally, the Department of Energy has finalized new energy efficiency standards for the most common types of light bulbs, continuing the Biden administration's efforts to save consumers money on their utility bills. The new standards are required by law and backed by manufacturers. They more than double the required efficiency of common bulbs.
Oh, Fox News is going to be mad. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.brandblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report. Thank you very much, Desi Doyen. And thanks to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program, download it anytime for free at bradblog.com. That is made possible, thank you, by those of you who stopped by bradblog.com/donate or just hit one of them donate buttons at bradblog.com. We couldn't do it without you. Drop me email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. And on the Facebooks, Mastodons, and sites still known as Twitter, you will find me at The Brad Blog. We will see you there. Till we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.